Greetings once again, America. My name is Doug McBurney, and you may have heard the news, but stand by now for the worldview. That's right, this is the Weekly Worldview. Welcome back to the show where we don't take calls. We don't tolerate sponsors, but we do focus on the events of the week through the lens of original thought, and it's been an eventful week, especially here in Colorado. We'll get to some of that, but I want to start today's broadcast by thanking Father Alvaro at St. Mary's Parish in Littleton. I want to thank him for having me physically removed, kicked off his property, and I want to thank whichever parishioner it was who called the police and had the police arrive. And because it gave, I'll explain briefly. We went there uninvited to gather signatures for the Brady Personhood Amendment, I and my three young children. And I had told the girls before we got there that we were going to gather signatures, and until someone asks us to leave, we're just going to gather signatures. When we're asked to leave, we're just going to leave. But as one great general once said, no battle plan survives the first shot. And while I had anticipated being asked to leave, I did not anticipate that the lead head priest, the big kahuna himself, Father Alvaro, would grab my petitions physically from my hands and then refuse to give them back to me. So I couldn't leave without my property, and I demanded my property be returned. And, well, the police came, and there was quite the scene, man. A lot of social tension. Father Alvaro had me removed physically, had me pulled over by the police in front of my kids. Now, my kids were traumatized. We're going to talk about that in a moment. I admit the kids were traumatized. But Father Alvaro gave me the opportunity this afternoon to discuss with my children the act of confronting religious institutions, the responsibility we have to confront religious institutions that are failing to uphold their responsibility to teach the flock to love their neighbors, which is what we were trying to teach them this morning. Now, last year, last campaign, Father Alvaro and the St. Mary's Parish invited us in, and we gathered hundreds and hundreds of signatures there. They even brought us pizza. It was a delight. But for whatever reason, this year we were not invited. And as I often want to do, I decided, you know, our campaign is about gathering signatures, putting the issue on the ballot, and having the entire state of Colorado vote on the issue, the fact that life begins at conception, the opportunity for every voter in Colorado to acknowledge that. That's one part of the campaign. But another part of the campaign, the long-term strategy, is to increase social tension over the legalized killing of children that's happening right in our midst. And so I went to St. Mary's today to get as many signatures as I could, but to also escalate social tension. And, well, we did just that. And my conversation with my daughters afterwards, especially my 12-year-old, it delved into criminal justice and just an all-around fruitful discussion with my kids. And we also talked on the drive home about the trauma that my children had suffered because my 12-year-old was crying. She was afraid Daddy was going to go to jail, and she'd be left there in the rain on the stoop of the church. She was scared, and she cried, so she was traumatized. But I had the opportunity to tell them about thousands of children every day in America who are burned with acid, and they have their arms and their legs ripped off. There's other children being traumatized and murdered. And quite often when you stand up in the face of this social injustice, that there's a good chance you'll be traumatized yourself. But keep in mind that the level of trauma we suffer is not even to be compared with the level of trauma that's being inflicted on the particular children being killed, on their mothers and fathers who've become the killers of innocent children, and upon the culture in general, which every day becomes more and more coarse. Because this legalized child killing is tolerated. So, Father Alvaro, thank you. And I hope you'll indulge me, you in the audience, because I'm just warming up for the letter that I'm going to write to Father Alvaro in regards to the events of this morning at St. Mary's Parish in Littleton. All right, so I guess that's about that. That's about it for that. But before we get into the news of the day, I guess this is the news of the day. I want to talk briefly about the floods here in Colorado. Here at the McBurney compound, we haven't suffered any major flooding. We had some water come through the basement window. We were able to mop it up with a towel. But yesterday, the hail came down, the tornado sirens went off, and I put my kids in the bathtub in the basement and put pillows and, I mean, we were ready. It was scary. But the McBurney compound has generally been spared, but many people around the state have not been spared, and there is a lot of suffering, even death, occurring here in Colorado with all the flooding. And those of a religious bent, especially Christians, may ask, are the floods in Colorado God's judgment? Is God trying to tell us something with all the flooding? Perhaps, I would posit, God is flooding Colorado because we legalized dope. Or maybe because we legalized civil unions and had our own governor participate in the civil union of a homosexual couple. Perhaps God is flooding Colorado because Mayor Hickenlooper stayed the execution of Nathan Dunlap, the Chuck E. Cheese murderer who was to be executed months ago. Perhaps God is flooding Colorado because the voters of Colorado twice now have rejected God's enduring command, you shall not murder, by voting against the personhood of every innocent child in two elections. And if you were a liberal, let's say you go to a liberal church, let's say you attend out there at St. Mary's or one of the various United Methodists churches here in the greater metro area, perhaps you think God is flooding Colorado because of the recall election against the Colorado State Senate president and other anti-Second Amendment gun grabbers. Maybe that's what the liberals think God is flooding Colorado for. But let us go to the scriptures. We're going to go to the book of 1 Kings. Warning, 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 Will Robinson, there are Bible verses up ahead. For those in the audience who advocate pluralism and diversity, we know here at the Weekly Worldview that you would like to censor anyone who would dare ever consider the possibility of even thinking about quoting a Bible verse in public. So this warning gives you fair notice that raw, unadulterated truth is about to be uttered. 1 Kings, the 19th chapter, then he said, go out and stand on the mountain before the Lord. And behold, the Lord passed by. And a great and strong wind tore into the mountains and broke the rocks in pieces before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a still small voice. God is not flooding Colorado. God is not trying to talk to us through floods. God is not trying to punish us for our collective or individual sins. God is trying to talk to us every day through his word and through his body, through what is written and those who carry what he has written to the world. So there's no need for God to flood Colorado. Colorado is flooding because we live in a fallen world. But keep in mind the still small voice, because that's where God is. He's not in the flood. He's in the still small voice that echoes in the conscience of every human being and gives them the opportunity to humble themselves before him, ask for his help, ask for his forgiveness, and trust him and believe he is who he said he is and that he will do what he has declared shall be done. So that's it for the floods. I've got a quote here. Oh, by the way, John Kerry, the Secretary of State, as much as it pains me to say that, John Kerry and Barry Ho could take a lesson from my confrontation with Father Alvaro at St. Mary's this morning. Because despite all my intentions I was going to go get signatures. When I was asked to leave, I was going to take my kids and go leave and get some ice cream. That was the battle plan. But my plan did not survive events on the ground. So Barry and Kerry, when you talk about going into Syria and getting involved in a civil war between one set of criminal fanatics against another set of Muslim religious fanatics, don't tell me that you're not going to put boots on the ground, because you don't know what's going to happen, you fools. I didn't know what was going to happen this morning. I dealt with it as best I could when the situation on the ground demanded that the plan be changed. And Barry and Kerry would be pushed into the same situation in Syria, were things not to go as anticipated. Or I guess as the Russians insist they will. So I hope Barry and Kerry are listening. Or I hope they're reading my email. I saw that in an email from my pastor earlier this week regarding the NSA spying and snooping and people scanning and looking, reading our emails. My pastor said, you know, if the government is reading my emails, at least I would think there was some hope for the country. All right. I want to go to, I got an email from Chris Tiemann out in Las Vegas. She's the matriarch of the Tiemann clan out there. She sent me a quote from H.L. Mencken. He states, as democracy is perfected, the office of the president represents more and more closely the inner soul of the people. On some great and glorious day, the plain folks of the land will reach their heart's desire at last, and the White House will be occupied by a downright fool and complete narcissistic moron. H.L. Mencken, The Baltimore Evening Sun, July 26th of 1920. So it's been a long time coming, and one could argue that the White House has regularly been occupied by such people and was probably occupied by such a person in 1920. And so that my warning goes out, my shot across the bow for Barry and Kerry. Listen to me, and well, don't bother listening to H.L. Mencken. I think he's dead and in hell, but I thought that was a funny quote. And I want to thank Chris, the matriarch of the Tiemann clan out in Las Vegas, for her contribution to the broadcast today. I've got a headline from CNN that I pulled down. I'm going to bounce this off my extremely attractive audio engineer just to see what she thinks. Perhaps you could answer this for me. Tattoos and piercings. How young is too young? That's the headline. Now, the fact that there could even be that headline in our nation makes me tremble for the future of civilization. How young is too young? And they talk about there's a battle over body modification that typically occurs between parents and their children, but now state legislatures are getting involved. They want to pass laws to restrict the tattooing and the piercing and the stretching and all other forms of body modification that people are participating in these days. It disgusts me, by the way. I've got a quote here from an assistant clinical professor in the Child Study Center at Yale University, the prestigious Yale University. He says, the brain of a young person is still developing and they are less risk-averse, more impulsive, and more likely to engage in risky behaviors. This is because the last part of the brain to develop is the part that tells them to put the brakes on before they do something potentially harmful and or dangerous, unquote. So that's what an assistant clinical professor of child studies at Yale University would have you believe. And I'm sure that it's physically true that the last part of the brain to develop is that part that keeps you out of trouble, or at least tells you when you're about to do something that could get you into trouble. But for all of you out there who have young children, first of all, if you're thinking about having them tattooed or pierced, just stop it, please. And second of all, while the brain may not be fully developed in a young person, starting around the age of 6 to 9 months, you can have a tremendous influence on developing the infrastructure of your child's brain so that even at a young age, your child will have the capacity to put the brakes on when they're about to do something dangerous or harmful. It's called training and discipline, and it's called avoiding hypocrisy in your own life. If you will train and discipline your child and raise your child in the fear and admonition of the Lord, and you will avoid hypocrisy in your own life, you can lay the groundwork upon which the amazing machinations that God built into the human brain will build in your child some sense of self-discipline and self-control. Worldview. We don't have time for all that music, boys. Put the guitars away. Thank you very much. Oh, and by the way, I was thanking the parishioner who called the police because I was unable to call the police. In fact, the priest asked me, he said, do you want me to call the police? I said, yes, you took my stuff. Call the police. So fortunately, someone else called the police and I was able to tell my story walking, as they say. All right, now from the Thou Shalt Not Steal file, we go to Boston in the Associated Press. The nation's oldest school system has joined a program of the U.S. Department of Agriculture that has spread to 10 states and the District of Columbia that offers students two free meals every day at school, whether they can afford it or not. It's spread to 10 states and the District of Columbia. Like a disease, these things spread. So what's happening here, ladies and gentlemen, is the government is feeding kids at school. They're taking money from you and I and other working people under threat of force, by the way. They're taking our money and they're giving it to other people who have not earned it. And now they don't even want to means test it, which was how they sold this to us in the beginning. You remember welfare? You don't remember because it happened 60 years before I was born. Welfare was to help the poor. It was going to be a safety net. And where's it? Well, I've got one clueless mother quoted here. This is a mother who every day takes her children to the godless government school factory and drops them off to be babysat and indoctrinated. And this clueless mother was asked by the Associated Press what she thinks of the program. And she said, well, it's one less weight and one less burden for parents. Isn't that wonderful? Ladies and gentlemen, if the government keeps taking the responsibilities of parents and stepping in and providing for those responsibilities, what do you think they're doing to those families? They're destroying families. So not only are they thieves, but they destroy families. And that's way worse. Welfare is much worse for the recipient than for the person from whom the money was stolen. Me and my family, the government's stealing half of our money right now, and we're going to be okay, okay? We'll muddle through. But these poor saps who are caught in the government welfare system are having their life force drained and sucked out of them by getting all this free government cheese, and they don't even realize it. Well, they will realize it at some point. The effects will be real in broken families and broken lives. But as for those of us from whom it's being stolen, well, we'll pony up and we'll get by. Now, this program I described from the U.S. Department of Agriculture that has spread like a fungus to 10 states and the District of Columbia, it's part of the Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act of 2010. Yeah, for schools to qualify, the feds say that more than 40% of the students have to be getting food stamps or other aid through certain other federal assistance program. So that's got to be about every school by now. You got to figure at least Barry and the other socialists who've been running the country for the better part of the past century have got at least 40% of the people hooked on the government cheese. Now the AP reports that besides easing hunger, school officials said the program eliminates the expense and time of handling paperwork for students who qualify for reduced or free meal. See, they no longer have to do all the paperwork involved to means test these programs because the mask is coming off. The liberals and the socialists are finally simply admitting, look, we just want you all to be dependent upon us, and we're willing to give it to you for free no matter what you make. Doesn't matter. They also say that not means testing and just offering free food to everyone, well, that helps erase a stigma that had plagued some students from poor families. They don't need the stigma anymore. Their plans are out in the open in the daylight now. It's to hook all of us, to make all of us dependent. And this is one of the reasons that here at the McBurney compound, we do not turn our children over on a daily basis to the godless education system. We educate our children at home, and we raise them in the fear and admonition of the Lord. Thank you very much. Can I get an amen? All right. I've got a quote here from a principal from one of the schools there in Boston. He says that the program is going to cut down on disruptions because hunger pangs could be linked to classroom misbehavior. Oh, really, Mr. Principal? Hunger pangs? I don't remember that negatively affecting Abraham Lincoln as he barely managed to eat two meals a day. Yet rose to become a self-educated lawyer and the president of the United States. I don't think hunger pangs are the issue. I think the biggest issue contributing to disruptions in school, in the government schools, is the fact that you teach the kids that they evolve from nothing and that there is no God and that there is no judgment day and that they're responsible only to themselves and to follow their own hearts. That's what contributes. It's not hunger. Hunger will motivate a kid to do amazing things, maybe even work. But these people are all addicted. They're all hooked into the system. They're hooked to the tit of the beast, so to speak. That may be a bit difficult to go down there, but that's what's happened. The principal says, we know that calm stomachs mean calm students who are ready to learn. The director of food and nutrition services for the Boston Public Schools. So right there, ladies and gentlemen, if you're going to send your children to an institution that has a director of food and nutrition services, you are a socialist. Yes, you're participating in socialism, in theft, in the destruction of families. It should be obvious because they have this position on staff. Anyway, the guy at Boston School says 76% of the students here already qualified for free or reduced price meals, so why not just open it up and give it to everybody? The program, this new program, giving free cheese to everyone, will save the district money as well. They won't have to hire couriers to drop off and pick up applications for welfare, and they may be able to cancel the armored car pickups for cafeteria money because there will no longer be any money involved. You'll only have to exchange your soul. No cash required. You only need pay with your own self-respect. That's all they want. They don't need your money. They've got all of my money, or about half of it. They don't need the money of these poor kids. All they want is them. Just give us your soul and yourself and buy into our program and keep the pittance that's in your pocket. I can't read any more of this. Okay, so that's, that's reason 710 to keep your children out or get your children out of the government schools. The government's going to try to addict them to free food and make them welfare recipients from the time they're five and 6 years old. And that's the age when you need to be laying that foundation in their brain housing group to relate to God and their fellow man. Not to be a dependent upon the government. All right. Now, we go to the bad religion file. Story from Florida. This is from Fox News. The Christian Service Center operates down there in Florida. For the past 31 years, the Christian ministry has been providing food to the hungry in Lake City, Florida, without any problems. Well, except the problem that the church here is overstepping its bounds, providing free food to people so that they won't learn how to work and take care of themselves. That's one small problem, but the church doesn't see that as a problem. I know. You people think that it's the church's place to give free food to people? You're wrong. It's not the church's place, and it's not the government's place. Paul said, if a man will not work, neither shall he eat. And Paul didn't say that because he thought the guy would starve to death. Paul said that because he knew that if the fellow got hungry enough, he'd work. And work is good. God likes men who work. God likes to work. He's creative. He made things. He created things. He wants us to do the same. He doesn't want us to become dependent upon Nimrod and the government cheese. So this Christian ministry has been inadvertently acting foolishly, handing out free food for over 30 years. But all that changed when they said a state government worker showed up to negotiate a new contract. Now, you might ask yourself, why is a Christian ministry that's handing out free food, why do they have to negotiate with the government? Well, that's because this church had bought into the USDA food program. That's where the government gives free food to religious and other social institutions so that they can pass on that welfare, that poison, to the masses. Well, they had this church hooked into it, again, attached to the tit of the beast. And these Christian this Christian ministry, they think they're doing a good thing by handing out government food. Well, the person from the state of Florida said that there'd been a change in the contract. The state of Florida would no longer allow institutions that are distributing the government cheese to have religious information wherever any USDA food is being distributed. They told them they had to take down all the references to religion or God or Jesus Christ if they wanted to continue to distribute this government cheese. So the leader of the ministry was told that they could continue distributing USDA food as long as it was somewhere else in the property, away from anything that could be considered religious. And the ministry decided to eliminate the USDA food, and they've said that we're going to trust God to provide for our ministry. And to me, this is just shameful that 30 years on, this pastor or preacher or teacher, whatever he is, this minister of Jesus Christ, and I believe he's a sincere brother, don't get me wrong, but it's just shameful that it's just now he's deciding he needs to trust God to provide. Maybe the people coming in for the free food day after day after week after month after year, the same people, maybe he should tell them to trust God to provide for their needs. And one of the ways God provides for your needs is hunger and thirst. Those are two of the fundamental building blocks of society. Hunger and thirst motivate people to go out and work, and when people work, they do good things and they improve themselves. They improve their relationship with their fellow man. They improve their relationship with God, and they build strong families. So you don't have to trust God to magically sprinkle down your provisions. God built it into the system if you would just pay attention to what he says and don't listen to anyone who says they're going to give you anything for free as if they're actually going to help you, because they are not. Did he say there, you know what I mean? He said something, you know what I mean. And then before that and after that, I really don't know what he meant. But I just like that, the whole rain theme and the guitar. But I really don't understand what you meant there. But we appreciate you contributing to the broadcast with the bumper music. Thanks to my extremely attractive audio engineer. We're going to go to the economics file, ladies and gentlemen. J.P. Morgan Chase, according to CNBC, has sent a memorandum to colleges notifying them that the bank will stop making new student loans in October. The official reason? They say in their memorandum, quote, "We just don't see this as a market that we can significantly grow." Yeah. CNBC reports that the move is eerily reminiscent of the subprime shutdown in home loans that happened back in 2007. Each time a bank shuttered its subprime unit, the news was presented in much the same way. Well, it's no longer sustainable. It's not the right place for us to allocate capital. When what was about to happen was the housing market and the mortgage market was about to collapse. And trillions of dollars were about to be erased from the economy. And CNBC, the headline, by the way, that John Carney, who wrote the story, no relation to Jay, I hope. John Carney, the headline reads, "The student loan bubble is starting to burst." CNBC, and this goes back to what I talked about with welfare, ladies and gentlemen. These government-subsidized loans are just another way to get people hooked into dependence upon the government instead of relying on God. And God hates that. He absolutely hates it. I know God is love, but God is very sophisticated. He loves all of us enough to give us room to repent. He loves all of us enough to give us the opportunity to follow him and to be with him and to walk with him and to learn from him. But there are many things that God hates, and I can tell you that welfare, government-subsidized student loans among them, are one of the things that God hates. Because he hates a lying tongue. And when you tell a kid that we can loan you all your money for college at 2% and everything's going to be fine, it's a lie. And God hates a lying tongue. Back to CNBC. Pull my head out of the Bible. Back to the CNBC report. There are over $1 trillion in outstanding student loans, making it the second largest source of household debt after mortgages. Just 10 years ago, student loans debt stood at $250 million. Now it's a quarter trillion. And in just 10 years, now it's over $1 trillion. And so this bubble is going to burst. And CNBC reports correctly, I do believe, that the entity with the biggest exposure to the student loan default is the United States government. That's because they weaseled and managed to work their way into every crevice part of American life. Got themselves involved in the student loans, got themselves involved in the mortgages, got themselves involved in the medical system. They've got themselves in the churches with their free government cheese programs and their other social welfare programs. And whether they've done it on purpose or not, I don't know. I'm not a big conspiracy guy, but I believe people conspire all the time because I do it myself quite often. I conspire with other people to achieve certain ends. But whether or not there's a conspiracy to set the civilization, the economy up for collapse, it doesn't matter. When you wire a society into dependence upon the government, as I've said before, God built judgment into the system. And when the government becomes this bloated and this much of a pack of thieves and liars, then the implosion is just a matter of time. It's predetermined. It's preordained. It was built into the system. God does not let corruption continue unabated and unpunished. Eventually, a day of reckoning will come, and I believe this student loan crisis, which will be occurring a year from now, we'll probably be talking about it, and we'll be counting the pennies left in our 401ks once again. And it will simply be the judgment that God built into the system. You can't lie to people and steal from people indefinitely without there being a major correction. And it's on its way, ladies and gentlemen. All right. I want to talk about this 9/11 event that happened up in Washington, D.C. Sturgis. My extremely attractive audio engineer. Asked me, was it Sturgis? Well, you know, the Muslims had said they were going to have a million Muslim march on 9/11, which I find distasteful, obviously. So what happened? How did America respond? The bikers of America, the bikers said that they were going to have a 2 million biker march. And I think only 13 Muslims showed up, but somewhere in the neighborhood of 300,000 motorcyclists, perhaps even more, rolled through D.C. on 9/11 to, I guess, represent America against the Muslim hordes. And I just want to remind people And I don't want to insult anyone, but generally, bikers are heathens. They're a bunch of wild, undisciplined heathens. Is this what represents America against the Muslims? Because if that's the case, ladies and gentlemen, I can assure you the Muslims will win out over the bikers. The bikers don't represent America, for crying out loud, and I'm embarrassed that they're the ones who had to go rolling up there into Washington, D.C. Or what's really annoying is that they feel like they can represent themselves as if they represent the average American, covered with tattoos and beards, with a quarter ounce of crystal meth in their pocket, driving around the country on their motorcycle. Yes, I know there are some bikers who are normal, average people, okay? I guess, or at least that's what I'm told. I don't personally know any. I don't think I know anyone with a motorcycle at this point in my career, dude. Oh, yeah, that doctor I know.
Yeah, one doctor.
Well, he's a heathen.
Yeah.
So there you go. My point is made. Even the doctor I know who rides his Harley, he's a God-hating heathen, and he has no right to go to Washington, D.C. and say he represents anything at all to do with anything to do with anything to do with America. Because America is a God-fearing nation built on the revealed law and character of nature and nature's God, the Christian God of the Bible, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of John, Matthew, Paul, and the Father of Jesus Christ. That's what America's built on. But I think that most of us Christians, we're working too hard. We can't just hop on our motorcycle and swing up to D.C. I don't know what bikers do for a living. Do they? I suppose they work. Anyways, I used to run with bikers. When I first came to Colorado, I was hanging siding with a maniac biker who didn't actually own a motorcycle. But he had the beard and the leathers, and I don't think he had any tattoos either, by the way. But he was a biker type. He took me to biker bars, and I hung with bikers for a little while, and they're generally a fairly distasteful lot, is all. I'm just going to leave it at that. And if that's what we expect to push back the tide of Islam that threatens America, well, I just don't have a lot of hope for that, okay? All right, now I've insulted everyone in the audience with a motorcycle. Please send me emails. I'd be happy. I would love to hear that there are Christian bikers out there. That would be good. It might change my perspective. All right. Say again?
Christian bikers don't go to Sturgis.
Christian bikers, yeah. Well, I hope Christian bikers don't go to Sturgis. Yeah. Oh, this guy wanted me to go to Sturgis with him.
Huh?
Well, my extremely attractive audio engineer would have none of that. And this was before the internet. But she was able to do a little bit of research. I think she went down to a local bar and sat with a couple of the bar flies and asked them, hey, what is this Sturgis thing? Came home that evening and she said, you're not going. And that was the end of my biker dabbling. That was it. It was over. All right, on to the bad religion file. This is from the Washington Times. The Muslim Brotherhood and its supporters have begun forcing roughly 15,000 Christians in Dalga village in Egypt to pay the jizya tax, as indicated in the most holy Quran. You remember the jizya? The jizya is a tribute. It's basically protection money that conquered non-Muslims historically had to pay to their Islamic overlords with willing submission and with feeling themselves subdued and to safeguard their existence. That's according to a fellow named Ibrahim. And you know a fellow named Ibrahim, he knows what he's talking about when it comes to the jizya. So the Muslims are taking over large swaths of Egypt, and they are persecuting the Christians, and the ones they don't kill or behead or rape their daughters, they're forcing them to pay this jizya tax. Just over the weekend, by the way, let's bring Syria into this. According to the Washington Times, just over this past weekend, Syrian rebels went into a Christian man's shop, and they gave him three options. Become a Muslim, pay a $70,000 jizya tax, or be killed along with his family. That's why this is in the bad religion file. Yeah, when the priest comes into town and he says, you either need to convert, pay this money, or we'll cut your head off, that's a bad religion. I want to thank, what was his name here? I don't want to mispronounce. I want to thank Father Alvaro for not threatening to chop my head off. I do one thing I can appreciate about the Catholic Church is they don't make you pay a jizya or threaten to kill you and your family. just if you stand up for the truth too forcefully, they will ask you to leave. And they will call the police. So that's the bad religion. And so I believe that Islam is a satanic religion. I do believe it. I don't believe that moderate Islamist people should be tolerated. I think that radical Islam must be toppled. Christianity must be preached. And at the end of the day, the Christian religion will win in the arena of ideas and philosophy. But we're going to have to kill the radicals, and we're going to have to tell the moderate Muslims, hey, your religion, we just can't have it, folks. And it's not like we're going to ban your religion, but we are going to aggressively preach the gospel of peace, the gospel of Jesus Christ, in hopes that we can save some of these people from this satanic religion. All right. Now, so that's what's happening with the Muslims. They're conquering Christian towns, cutting people's heads off, killing people, putting them under slave-like tribute. So there is a war against the West. And what are we doing here in America to bolster our forces against the mighty warriors of Allah? Well, here's what's happening. This is from military.com. Angela Shunk and her wife. I know I can't even say it. Angela Shunk and her wife, Tech Sergeant Stacy Shunk, have received orders to the Hill Air Force Base in Utah. They're the first homosexual couple in the Air Force to receive an assignment together under the service's joint spouse program. Yeah, that's it. That's what we're doing in our military to build up our forces. As the threat of imminent world war hangs over the entire world, we're shipping girls off with girls, and it's just disgusting. All right. All right, more from the war file. This is from the Los Angeles Times. A top secret 2009 document leaked by Ed Snowden, a memorandum of understanding between the NSA and its Israeli counterpart, says the U.S. government regularly hands over intercepted communications communications that have not been reviewed by U.S. analysts, and therefore they may contain phone calls and emails of American citizens. Folks, Edward Snowden should be covertly targeted for assassination. Yeah, after an operation to try to recover whatever we can that he stole. And his queer Guardian reporter friend and all the other deviant perverts who are sustaining this fella over there in Russia. By the way, he's in Russia. Yeah. They should all be arrested. And if tried and if convicted, they should all be executed for treason. Of course, we hand over intelligence to the Israelis, and the Israelis hand intelligence over to us. And for Snowden to reveal this, well, if there was ever a call for a drone strike, it's Edward Snowden and that homosexual reporter and over there at The Guardian. I've got a quote here from someone, the legal director for the American Civil Liberties Union. He has to chime in. Here's what he says about this leak, revealing the regular exchange of intelligence between the U.S. and Israeli intelligence services. Here's what's his name? Jamil Jafar, legal director of the American Civil Liberties Union, says, quote, "The implications are unsettling. You can imagine a scenario in which somebody tries to get on a plane and is told by some foreign airline, we have you on a list. Or if you try to get a visa and you're told, unfortunately, we can't give you a visa." Unquote. The American Civil Liberties Union. Now, I don't know that he's a homosexual, but I assume he is. Because according to the McBurney Doctrine, if you harbor homosexuals and you advance the homosexual agenda, then you are a homosexual, as far as I'm concerned. All right, finally, not finally, wait, are we out of time yet? Oh, no, but we're long on a break. Should I do this science story? All right, finally, from the science, really, file. 15 years ago, the world of science was rocked by a discovery that, contrary to our notions of gravity, distant galaxies appeared to be flying apart at an ever-accelerating rate. The observation implied that space itself was stretching apart faster and faster. It was akin to watching a dropped ball reverse course, speed upward, and disappear into the sky. Well, the discovery made many cosmologists, that's the scientists who probe the very nature of nature itself, Well, it made these cosmologists acutely uncomfortable, for either our understanding of gravity is cockeyed, or some mysterious repulsive force, which has now been dubbed dark energy, permeates the universe. Now, this is from the Washington Post, by the way. So what happened was the Big Bang cosmologists and their predictions, when they looked at the shape of the universes or the galaxies, they found out that their predictions were wrong and they were not supported by the empirical data that could be observed. And so they had to introduce something, and they introduced dark energy. Yeah. Now, nobody's ever seen any dark energy. We don't know if it exists, but they say it must exist because we can't be wrong. The universe exploded out of nothing for no reason, and it's flattened and inflated, and we're sticking to our story, that's all. It's not that the scientists are acutely uncomfortable. It's that they're being proven dead wrong. Yeah. Even though, according to this article from the Washington Post, back in 2011, the Nobel Committee blessed the improbable discovery of dark matter as real. So the Nobel Committee, didn't they give a prize to Barry? The Peace Prize, for crying out loud. Well, now, after years of planning and construction, four new projects at telescopes in Chile, Hawaii, and the South Pole are getting a handle on what exactly is doing this unseemly pushing in the universe that former cosmological models simply cannot account for. Unseemly pushing? Unseemly? So this article is obviously written with a bias toward the Big Bang. The reporter who wrote this is biased because this data, this empirical data that disagrees with Big Bang atheist cosmology, he calls it unseemly. So I just wanted to point out the bias, although I know it's fairly obvious. Anyway, I support these efforts, though, to look for dark matter. I support them in full. I might even make a donation because I know that my God wrote the history of the heavens and the earth in the substance of the heavens and the earth themselves. I know it's there. And I know the more these heathens look, the more they will find that it's the Big Bang theory that's flying apart. Yeah, it's their entire atheistic, undirected, godless cosmology that's flying apart, not just the galaxies they see. You want to talk about a flying spaghetti monster, all you heathens out there who think that's so cute and so pithy. The Big Bang cosmologists turn out to be the actual flying spaghetti monster. It's the Weekly Worldview, and I'm your host, Doug McBurney. I want to thank you all for flying along with us on the spaceship reality here. Anyway, I'm reading a paper written by I'm not allowed to say, it's all top secret, but a competing cosmology to the Big Bang is being developed, and has been developing for quite some time. There has been many fractures developing in the whole Big Bang cosmology ever since we've been able to more accurately study the cosmic background microwave radiation. And anyway, there's a lot of big things coming, ladies and gentlemen. But bottom line, it's going to be fairly hard for the atheist cosmologist Big Bang crowd to support their theory as evidence keeps coming in. It's good to be a theoretical physicist, but your theoretical tends to fall flat in the face of mountains of data that keep coming in as we look further and further out into space. And we find out that indeed, there is order in space. That it didn't just explode out of nothing for no reason by nobody. And of course, that's obvious to those of us who are in the know, who have a relationship with the Creator. But to most of the world, they all believe that the Big Bang is true. They believe it like a religion. And, well, big religions fall too. All right, now let's talk about the fruit that has been produced by Big Bang Cosmology. And for that, we're going to go to Middlesex County, Virginia. Investigators report that a crying and distraught father, one Travis Baker, walked into the Middlesex County, Virginia office last Sunday evening and told investigators that he had snapped and shot his wife in the head. When deputies arrived at the house, they found Wendy Billups, his wife. I'm sorry, his girlfriend, shot dead. I assumed it was his wife because they had kids together. That's a mistake. You can't assume that anymore. I apologize. Billups was Baker's girlfriend, and she was raising the couple's two young children. He came to visit on the young boy's birthday. She told him he could not visit and he would have to leave, so he shot her twice, killing her. Now, how does this go back to Big Bang Cosmology? It's simple, ladies and gentlemen. When you eliminate God from the equation, as a person's life develops, their mind develops, their self-esteem develops, their habits develop. Absent of God, well, when you get in a situation when somebody makes you mad, you might just kill them. Because there is no God, there is no judgment day, we're not accountable to anyone. We evolved from slime, we don't know where we've been, we don't know where we're going. But I know I'm mad right now at this person, I'm going to kill them. And then they do it. Whereas someone who is restrained within the bounds of Christian liberty would not shoot and kill someone just because they were angry with them. But more and more, murder has become an acceptable solution for more and more people because we have eliminated God from the hearts and minds of the people. Even if they don't believe in God, even if they're not Christians, a culture that is permeated with godliness will deter criminals from acting on their vile passions. God tells us the people will hear and fear, right? Because obviously God wants everyone to believe in him and follow him and have a relationship with him. But he knows that if they choose not to, they're going to be dangerous and he wants them to be restrained. And only godliness can restrain the wicked. Godliness in our government, godliness in our families, godliness in our justice system. But we don't have that. What we do have, from CNN, a woman in Montana is accused of pushing her husband off a cliff after an argument. The pair had been married for 8 days. Jordan Lynn Graham is charged with second-degree murder. She recently told her friend she was having second thoughts about marrying Cody Johnson. The couple argued and then decided to go hiking in Glacier National Park in Flathead County, Montana, where they continued to fight. And at some point, she pushed Johnson with both of her hands in the back, and he fell face first off a cliff. That's what she told police. She did it. She said, I did it. I pushed him off the cliff. She's been released from jail on bail as we go to press. She's actually out of jail on bail. After all she did was kill somebody. I mean, it's fairly common anymore. You know, sure, we'll let her out on her own recognizance. I don't know. There's some talk they're going to try to have her arrested again. We'll see. All right. Now let's talk about the fruit of this culture that tolerates, encourages, and even funds the legalized murder of certain classes of people. We're going to go to, this is a CNN story. Rami Lee is a young girl's name. She was madly in love with John Weldon, and they were dating. And, of course, they were dating in the modern sense, which means before long she found out she was pregnant. So they went together for a sonogram at Weldon's father's Tampa area clinic. The test showed that she was 6 weeks pregnant. Now, despite her boyfriend's reluctance, the young lady, Rami Lee, planned to have the baby. Well, days later, the father told the mother that her blood test had shown she had an infection and she needed to take antibiotics. And he gave her some pills, told her, take 3 pills a day. Well, after she took only 1 pill, she was rushed to the hospital with abdominal pain and bleeding, and she lost her baby because the father of that child had tricked her into taking an abortion pill. When doctors inspected the pills, they discovered it was not antibiotics, but abortion pills.
It's the girl
No, the father of the child, the girl's boyfriend. The father of the child murdered his own son, lied and deceived the mother of his child in order to kill his own child. So, this father has accepted a plea deal that could send him to prison for perhaps 13 years. And he wasn't, by the way, he made a deal. Now, the state had threatened they were going to take him to court under a rarely used federal Unborn Victims of Violence Act. Rarely used. That's a gross understatement. But that's a murder charge that they threatened him with. But they ended up making a deal to save the court time and money, and you don't have to shuffle all the papers around and stay in your office at late hours. He pled to tampering with a consumer product. And so the murder of an unborn child by his own father was set aside by our justice system in favor of a plea deal to tampering with a consumer product. And that's the fruit of your godless Big Bang cosmology. Thank you to all of you scientists who have trained a generation to godlessness. This is the fruit. And if I wanted to, ladies and gentlemen, I could spend my hour a week or even an hour a day or even 3 hours a day just reporting on the murder and the mayhem and bloodshed in our midst in neighborhoods and towns and cities and farms all across the country because it's epidemic. How long will it take you people to realize that at some point we must stand up and we must say no more? In fact, not only are we going to draw the line here, we're going to push the line back on you godless heathens who are killing us. And we're going to try to save you from killing yourselves. All right. Now, I don't want to leave you down in the mouth, so I want to end with an upbeat story. We go to Albuquerque, New Mexico. Police say that Emilio Chavez, a father, found 29-year-old Dylan Majo naked outside of his daughter's window and making noises. Outside of his daughter's window. So the father, Emilio Chavez, beat Majo, the peeper, so badly that he was taken to the hospital. While both men could be convicted of felonies, the father faces a potentially longer sentence than the peeping Tom for what he did to the intruder. Now, police who arrived at the scene, they initially let the father go free. They probably patted him on the back, offered him a cigar, said, "Hey, can we buy you a drink?" That's probably how the police reacted. But he's now been charged with aggravated battery, which is a felony. Now, the pervert, at last report, he remains in the hospital. Now, that's pretty good. He beat him pretty good. I mean, when did this happen? He's been in the hospital for several days. So, way to go, Dad. Now, he's been formally charged with felony voyeurism. And he will be charged if and when he's released from the hospital. Now, the father said that he was just so angry the night he caught the peeping Tom outside his daughter's window that he doesn't even remember assaulting the man. He just went into a frenzy, as you can well imagine. Anyway, this peeping Tom is well known around the neighborhood. Around here, they call him, one neighbor said, around here we call him the nudist. So here's this peeping Tom. He's been terrorizing this neighborhood. The father beats him within an inch of his life. The crowd goes wild and cheers. And the justice system wants to charge him with a more serious crime than the peeping Tom who was outside of his daughter. So that's not a very upbeat story at all, is it? Except for the beating of the pervert. I guess I found that to be satisfying enough to justify this being the closing story and trying to lift your spirits knowing that at least in Albuquerque, there's at least one father left who will beat a peeping Tom senseless outside of his daughter's window. That gives me some hope for the future of the country, and I say that in all Christian love. Yes, because this peeping Tom, he's never going to have an opportunity to repent if someone doesn't get his attention and let him know he's a pervert on his way to hell. And I think this dad, I think he got his attention. At the very least. All right, that's it, folks. That's the Weekly Worldview for this week. I want to thank my friends at KGOV.com, that's KGOV.com, Denver Bible Church, American Right to Life, Personhood USA,
And as always, my other brother, Darrell, who makes it all happen here at the Weekly Worldview Studios. Should the Lord tarry, I will return next week. And until then, may the grace of God go with you. And may the peace of Jesus Christ be upon you.